What is the weight of reputation? Not in the military or power sense, not in the reputations we carve out for ourselves, but rather the images others develop about who they think we are. How do we cope with what others perceive of us? And how do we contribute to our own reputations without even realizing the harm we might be doing? 70 miles east of Dallas lies Grand Saline, Texas, a city wrestling, and not, with the weight of these kinds of questions. This is a place of polite, friendly folk, and yet a city perceived to be so racist that people of color don't even stop for gas on their way through. The stories passed on by school kids over the generations like a century and a half long game of telephone, stories of beatings of African Americans, stories of bullying and intimidation and of terrorized black residents run out of town, they might just be stories, but they are powerful enough stories to keep African Americans far away from this otherwise totally typical small town in East Texas. And they were powerful enough to compel one man, a white Christian minister, to take one dramatic step to bring attention to how unfriendly Grand Saline is, or is only perceived to be, to African Americans. To better understand where this racist image comes from, why it persists, and how it drove one man to commit an astonishing act to draw attention to it, we start with what took place in broad daylight on the late afternoon of June 23rd, 2014.
A lot of people didn't notice that he was there all day long because he moved his car, I think, three or four times.
Mallie Munn is 22 years old on this particular afternoon. She and two friends, Angie and Steven, are sitting on a bench in front of what was then the Sophisticuts hair salon where she worked.
He was keeping it subtle enough that if you were there all day, you'd notice him, but if you were just coming and going, you probably wouldn't even realize he was there.
She's been watching this man mill around the parking lot all day. He's not nervous, per se. He's just off.
And I was like, does he have a gardening cushion? Like, what's happening?
She figures he might be there to pick the weeds out of the cracks in the parking lot, and she debates going over to tell him that somebody's already been by to do that.
And then he started dumping a gas can on himself, and we were like, no, that's, I was like, is that gas? They were like, that has to be water. Like, it can't, that can't be real.
She and her friends are about 35 yards away.
I could hear the click of the lighter, like as far away as it was, because I saw it and I went, there's a lighter, to Steven. And I said it, and I mean, as soon as it clicked and it went, oof, he was gone. I was inside getting the fire extinguisher, and Angie was on the phone.
911.
This is Angie at the Dollar General.
In what city?
At Grant Saline, and a man's on fire out in the parking lot.
The man is on fire?
Yes, a man just set himself on fire.
He set himself on fire?
Literally. They're trying to put him out
in
right
Grand
now.
In Grand Saline at the Dollar General?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, I'm going to get somebody headed that way.
The man was Charles Moore, a white Christian minister and Grand Saline native, and a bit of a prodigal son. Moore spent most of his life far removed from the town he grew up in, which itself was considered a stronghold for the Ku Klux Klan when he was a young man. Moore's belief in social justice led him to picket the Vietnam War in the early 70s, go on a two-week hunger strike against the United Methodist Church's stance on gays and lesbians in the 90s, and his activism and missions led him to the poorer parts of the world where he hoped to hold the powerful accountable for inhumane treatment of powerless citizens. And less than a month before his 80th birthday, Charles Moore returned to Grand Saline after several years away with a can of gasoline and a typed note, hoping to draw the attentions of the world to the injustices he saw in his hometown, where African Americans had been unwelcome, intimidated, and insulted as far back as he could remember. Which is exactly how he saw it. He wanted his dramatic death in one of the most public places in town to force Grand Saline's residents to ask themselves some hard questions about who they were, and to atone for a culture of racism that led back decades before he was even born. So, question number one, is that how it turned out?
I think a lot of people got very angry at his message instead of absorbing it and hearing it for what it was and trying to understand it from someone else's perspective. I think they just got upset. Well, we're not like that anymore. That was back then when he was here. He hasn't been here in years.
Not long before I meet up with Mallie Munn at her mother's house, I walk around Grand Saline with my camera in my hands. I'm approached by a man named Paul who doesn't want to be on the radio but does want to know what brings a photographer to Grand Saline. I tell him I'm no photographer, just a reporter who needs some photos for the website. I fill him in that I'm here to look into the story told by two filmmakers in a documentary called Man on Fire. Directed by Joel Fendelman and produced by Grand Saline native James Chase Sanchez, the film looks into the very story I'm here to find out more about. Like everyone I will meet eventually on this cool autumn Monday, Paul is cheerful, friendly, and white. I ask Paul if he remembers Reverend Moore's suicide. He does. I ask him if he thinks Reverend Moore's message got through the way it was intended to. He does not. Paul shakes his head and tells me he just doesn't understand what Reverend Moore was railing against. He never saw the oppression or the brutality or the overt indignity against African Americans that Moore claimed in his suicide note. He tells me that his perspective is the general consensus among the people who live in Grand Saline, that Reverend Moore was misguided, misinformed, and clearly out of his mind. A few hours later, I'm sitting in my car just as the pale blue morning finally muscles through the gray clouds overhead. And while I eat my chicken sandwich, I think back over my conversation with Paul. And I have an obvious thought, given the subject of this story. I'd really like to hear what a black resident of Grand Saline has to say. The trouble is, I can't find one. Not at the gas station across the street, not walking around town, not even in the passenger seat of a car zipping out of town on Highway 80. It turns out I'm actually not just missing something. In 2016, the U.S. Census put Grand Saline's population a bit over 3,000. 54 were black. The makers of Man on Fire couldn't find any black Grand Saline residents either. They did get a few black voices from residents of neighboring towns almost 30 and 40 miles away. Young or old, they don't paint a pleasant picture of what Grand Saline means to them.
Lynch people there, they don't like you, they're gonna chase you out of town.
Us, we all grew up and heard the same stories. You don't go to Grand Saline. You don't talk to people from Grand Saline.
They had a place, they said this is where that they would hang them.
You'll notice something, though, about these and other interviewees if you watch the film, that they heard stories, that they were told to beware of Grand Saline. But eyewitness accounts of actual, real physical aggression in town are really pretty scant. This is a sticking point for Elvis Allen, Van Sant County's chief historian. I meet up with Alan at the Salt Palace, a cozy museum and gift shop celebrating Grand Saline's other reputation as the producer of most of the pretzel salt Americans consume. It's a small, dark wooden building on the corner of Highway 80 and Main Street that looks like the last remnant of a Colorado mining town, restored to loving detail and complete with the largest grain of salt most of us will ever see. Alan and Kay Barber, the one minding the store this morning, are chatting about what they call the myth of Grand Saline's reputation as a racist preserve.
I've heard people say, they say. You hear that a lot when you're interviewing people. Nobody's ever actually dug into the past, researched it, and then wrote it.
Alan fumbles with a bit of loose change in his pocket while Barber veers away to chat with another visitor at the Salt Palace. In his 70s, Elvis Allen is in possession of an almost supernatural knowledge of historical events and places in this city, which means he's spent a good part of his life coping with what he says are the unwarranted myths about his hometown.
I don't keep up with the myth around here.
Yeah, well, I mean, just what?
There's the kids perpetuated at school is where a lot of problems is. There's never been a black man run out of this town that I know of in the 20th century.
This is no anachronism, by the way. He's referencing the 20th century because he says people think violence and physical intimidation against black people happened in Grand Saline within the last couple of decades. Allen ticks off a short list of black business owners and black workers who lived in Grand Saline at the end of the 19th and the beginning of the 20th centuries. They never faced any violence to his knowledge, but by the 1920s, these few black proprietors and workers drifted away because the black community here was just too small. The myth that Grand Saline is an overtly racist, even brutal town, he says, goes way back to the post-Civil War years.
The violence against blacks was mostly involved one incident during the Reconstruction.
That incident, actually more of a short time period, centers around a Confederate outlaw named Ben Bickerstaff, who most historical accounts will tell you was pretty violently racist. Bickerstaff gathered up what Elvis Allen calls like-minded individuals to terrorize small towns of or friendly to African Americans in the post-war years. And this, Allen says, is where the perception of aggressive racism in Grand Saline began, with the beheading of a white doctor who treated black patients. His head, or so the legend goes, was hung on a pole, and so the urban legends grew.
That is where the myth began. It got turned around over years later that he was a black man, and then it turned into several black men, and it went on, and it came from that.
It doesn't help that one particular end of Grand Saline is called Pole Town. The historical plaque marking the settlement states that the name came from the thin pole-like trees the first settlers used to build homes in 1863. But that hardly makes for good urban legend now, does it? Not when you can spread stories that Pole Town was a shrine decorated with the heads of African Americans. Stories like these, unverified and passed along in school, are a lot of the reason Grand Saline still has the reputation it has. And it is a pretty devastating reputation. One elderly black gentleman interviewed in Man on Fire states it like this.
If I could jump over Grand Saline, I'd jump.
All right, Uncle
Clayton. Well, you're speaking true.
I have to admit, walking around in the cool autumn sunshine downtown, I do kind of want to see somebody bounding through the air on their way to nearby Mineola. But then I remember how sad I felt when I first heard that man say that. Wherever its reputation comes from, however true or untrue it might be, Grand Saline is off limits to African Americans, if only because black East Texans have taken it upon themselves to cordon off the city like a quarantine zone. That's a thought I can't shake. The idea that whether black fears of Grand Saline are completely justified or completely inaccurate, they do come from somewhere. And they persist because maybe nobody bothers to stop these tales school kids weave, or maybe because nobody has explained what impact these stories have had over the years, so nobody in town realizes what's going on beyond its borders. Even far outside the city limits, the legend of Grand Saline as a racist haven was so strong that Man on Fire's director Joel Fendelman worried what he would walk into.
When I went in to Grand Saline, after hearing the stories, knowing of the rural South and its history, I was expecting actually much more of an explicit racism. And what I came away with was a much, much more nuanced and implicit racism.
Fendelman is a Jewish man born in Miami who now lives in New York. That makes him not exactly a stranger to prejudice, implied or otherwise. He attended film school at the University of Texas in Austin, which is, by the way, where he met James J. Sanchez through some mutual friends. And Fendelman says the outward niceness of Grand Saline and its residents immediately struck him.
Everyone was so kind to us, and they spoke, I think, for the most part, from their heart. I think sometimes they were a little delicate on what they were saying, but generally spoke what we asked, or answered what we asked. And I don't think people were necessarily aware of the implicit racism that exists. And so what I learned in going into this process was how racism exists in contemporary America for the most part. It's not as explicit as I thought about from the 1960s and 70s and the movies and civil rights movement. It's much more subtle.
Subtle. Yeah, that's a lot tougher to define, huh? But if you watch Man on Fire, you'll see what Fendelman is talking about. Resident after resident decries racism in all its forms, sincerely, too. I mean, you're left with the sense that the people in this film really wouldn't tolerate aggression or ugliness toward black residents or anyone else. But there are moments. Not racist, but not racist. More the kind of racism that doesn't even realize it's being racist. Maybe even well-intentioned. But it's there. And that's not to suggest that Grand Saline hasn't had its episode of more overt racism. Like every town, it's got its share of people who don't like anyone who's not like them, its share of school kids using words they shouldn't or making jokes they probably never would make in the company of certain others. And one of those kids was James J. Sanchez. See, the thing about Grand Saline is that while it is overwhelmingly white, there is a hefty Latino population in town. Still, Sanchez, despite his last name, is only a quarter Latino and three quarters white. And that greatly helped him assimilate into the city's predominantly white culture.
I'm definitely brown. I'm browner than most of the white people. My last name is Sanchez. So I definitely, stood out a bit. But, I didn't speak Spanish. And my mom, I was raised by my single mom in town, and she's white. And so in some ways, I identified with my whiteness.
Identifying as white meant some occasional dropping of the N-bomb and a football team slogan that went,
"We're all right because we're all white." And so there were little racial things. And a coach once saying, that black kids on the other team have like extra muscles in their legs. And that was accepted as a truth in Grand Saline growing up.
The irony, Sanchez says, is that while he was being racist himself, his being part Latino was enough to garner him racist nicknames.
One of my nicknames in high school was Wetback, Beaner. I mean, people called me that all the time. So I'm weird in that I fit into both modes of perpetuating the racism and also being a victim of the racism. But ultimately, yeah, I view that I was complacent and didn't do anything. In these moments where these racist things happen, I was telling these stories and or were letting other people tell them.
Lest you worry that Sanchez still perpetuates racism, he doesn't. Today, he's an assistant professor of writing at Middlebury College in Vermont and writes frequently on race, stereotypes, and the weight of language on how we see each other. He's ashamed of his past racism, but says it made him better attenuated to the subtler side of it. And he comes clean about who he is because he says the only way to deal with something that ugly is to own up to it, whether you're a person or a city with a severe public image problem.
I think a lot of the younger people in high school now maybe don't know as many of the same stories as they used to be. But what's so interesting is that while Grant Saline doesn't view itself as racist as they used to be, many of the people in the outside of communities, younger and older, still share this knowledge of them. They still view Grant Saline as racist. So to ultimately, I would say to change this, what they would have to do is publicly address it. You have to deal with it. You have to sit down and have a conversation and say, we don't want to be known as racist anymore. We feel like that's unjustified and that we're not that as a community anymore. And we want to be open for all people. You have to have some public dialogue about that. If you don't, no one in the outside communities are ever going to think anything differently about it. And the people in Grant Saline will never have to deal with it.
All that said, Sanchez does say it's unfair to make Grant Saline the poster child for white racism. In fact, he says there's nothing unique about the people in town. They're as racist and as not as people from any other town in Texas or anywhere else. Generally, he agrees with the assessment of Samantha Adams, who calls the level of racism and insensitivity in this town
unintentionally racist because it's the environment they grew up in.
I meet up with Adams under the Dollar General sign on Highway 80. This is the parking lot where Charles Moore self-immolated, just a few feet from where I'm parked.
They don't know any other way. For the older people, I'm sure that they don't think that it's racist, but that doesn't make it not racist, right?
Adams is white, in her mid-20s. In high school, a decade ago, she had a black boyfriend. She heard her share of insults about it, directly and indirectly. She tells me what some of the other kids said, but at the risk of editorializing, you know what kind of stuff it was, and you don't need to hear either of us say it. And yet, Adam sees much of the problem as an offshoot of Grand Saline simply having evolved as an insular community.
It's ignorance, not stupidity, but just a lot of people that live here have never left here. They grew up here, they went to high school here, they met the love of their life here, and they didn't leave. For, I think, a lot of younger people, especially for me, I left, I went places, I saw different cultures, and it allows you to see things that you maybe wouldn't see if you didn't get to experience that.
Adams does say the city's getting better, but there are still two main issues that people from the outside, especially African Americans, haven't heard that the town is trying to turn its reputation around. And that whether that reputation is warranted, it has to come from somewhere.
Most black people don't even stop here. That's something I've always thought. If this isn't a racist town, why don't we see more black people even just stopping at the gas station? And when they stop, what happens?
Again, though, Adams is not down on Grand Saline. And she says the kinds of racist attitudes that she was aware of back in high school are not so prevalent these days.
10 years ago, my sister was in the Easy Mart that used to be up on the corner, and a black man walked in, and the lady at the counter said, "We have to hurry and get him out." You wouldn't hear that today. I think the biggest thing that holds Grand Saline back is that there are so many people that don't want to see it. So they convince themselves it's not a problem, and they never address it.
But she does see hope.
It has gotten better, I will say that. I have a nephew, and he is mixed. So I have noticed that, like, when he makes friends around our neighborhood, they're all nice, you know. No one's ever really said anything to him, so I always thought that was an improvement.
The thing to keep in mind is that reputation is extremely hard to alter, and no matter how much soul-searching anyone in Grand Saline might ever do, No matter how tolerant or accepting its residents might be or might become, it is how other people outside of Grand Saline look at the city that will be the final arbiter in whether African Americans will ever feel safe dropping into town, or buying a house, or even getting gas. For Sanchez, the end of the stories about racist violence and intolerance is the cornerstone of changing Grand Saline's reputation.
I think what troubles me the most is that this is perpetuated by young people, and I remember perpetuating this and being a part of it in high school. But I also know that the elders in the community know about these stories, and they told some of us these stories and laughed about them on camera, and know that the kids tell these stories. And no one is trying to stop these stories from spreading. And I think ultimately that's the thing that you have to do, is you have to stop these stories. And if you're just going to sit back and be quiet and just be like, oh, it's all folklore, who cares? Then you're complicit in this reputation of your town. You're ultimately not trying to change anything. You're okay with your community being labeled racist.
And this reputation is something the older folks in town say they're just as eager to see go away before it strikes fear into anyone else's heart or compels another of its citizens to commit a dramatic suicide to get things to change. This episode of Convo was written, produced, and reported by Scott Morgan. Music used in this podcast by Gil Talmy from the film Man on Fire and by White Sand. To support this program and others like it, please visit ketr.org.